screaming gang, gang, now you wanna rap. Racketeering charges, caught him on the tap. Looking for a bond, lawyers wanna tax. Purple hair, got them faggots on your back.
What's free? Free is when nobody else can tell us what to be. Free is when the TV ain't controlling what we see. Told my niggas I need you. Through all the fame, you know I stay true. Pray my niggas stay free. Made a few mistakes, but this ain't where I wanna be. Before I'm judged by 12, put a 12 on my feet. Told my niggas I need you. Stay up, I know these times ain't true. Real life, yeah. What's free? Fed investigations, heard they plotting like I trapped. 20 million cash, they know I got that off a rap. Maybe it's the Michael Rubens or the Robert Krafts. Or the billionaire from Marcy in the way they got my back. See how I prevailed and now they try to knock me back. Block me in the cell for all them nights and I won't snack. 250 a show and they still think I'm selling crack. When you bring my name up to the judge, you tell them facts. Tell them how we funding all these kids to go to college. Tell them how we ceasing all these wars, stopping violence. Trying to fix the system in the way that they designed it. I think they want me silenced. Oh, say you can see. I don't feel like I'm free. Locked down in my cell, shackled from ankle to feet. Judge banging that gavel, turned me to slave from a king. Another day in the bing. I gotta hang from a string. Just for popping a willy, my people monster the city. From a cell to a chopper, view from the top of the city. You can tell how we rockin' soon as I pop up. We litty popping like Bad Boy in 94. Big popping.
All right. So we're about to start the show. Welcome to DTF Radio. I am your host, McKinney McKinney, and you are now tuned in to Facing the Truth. First, I would like to give thanks to God for allowing me to go through the trials that have polished my imperfections, illuminated my strength, in order to become resilient enough to be able to talk to you beautiful people today. This evening, just to get further acquainted, I'm a lifestyle blogger, event planner, women's empowerment organizer, showcase manager, advocate for mass incarceration awareness, entrepreneur, and last but certainly not least, I am the wife of wrongfully convicted Ricardo Marston. You can find more of our story by following me on IG at McKinney101. That's M-A-K-I-N-I 101. This program is formulated to further bring awareness to mass incarceration while empowering the families of the incarcerated and provide resourceful information. Today, I will be sitting down with Khalil Kamabach from the New Yorkers United for Justice and Dominic Dupont. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
What's good? Thanks for having us, sis.
No problem. So, why don't we start by sharing exactly to the audience who you are and what it is that you guys do individually?
So, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So, thank you again for having me back, McKinney. And shout out to all the listeners and viewers on IG Live. So, my name is Khalil Kamabach. I'm the chief strategist at a not-for-profit organization called New Yorkers United for Justice. And it's our goal to pass legislation in New York State that would help to realign and restructure the criminal justice system as we know it. Some of the issues that we worked on include bail, speedy trial, discovery, but also working on comprehensive parole reform, expanded use of clemency, and the expanded use of expungement.
Okay.
Thank you, sis. So my name is Dominic Dupont, and first of all, shout out to all the listeners, to all the viewers on live on IG. I served 20 years, 7 months, and 18 days in maximum security prisons all across New York State and was recently released approximately 17 months ago after receiving executive clemency from Governor Cuomo. And I currently hold the position of Director of Programs for MKW, which stands for Making Kids Win, and also hold the title of Community Liaison for a theater company called Theater War Productions. Our sole goal for Making Kids Win is right there in the context of that statement, to make kids win. We want to make sure that we interrupt the school-to-prison pipeline by educating some of the people who are making decisions and supporting laws that would put young people away for a long time. So I was the subject of a documentary that aired on HBO, produced by my uncle, Michael K. Williams. called Raising the System. So thanks for having us, sis.
No problem, no problem. So since re-entering back into society, you've both been extremely active, obviously, in bringing awareness to ending mass incarceration. Some of the things you have been advocating is to push legislative laws to reform probation and reentry, along with expungement of records for previous offenders of nonviolent crimes. You've also called to action for Governor Cuomo to use his executive authority to push for more pardons and clemency in the state of New York. So since taking office, Governor Cuomo has granted 7 general pardons, 59 immigration pardons, and 144 conditional youth pardons. A lot of people don't seem to understand that, yes, he's done a lot, and he's done a great deal for us so far with even taking that into action, but there's a lot more that needs to be done, considering that there's so many people that are incarcerated right now, and so many families that are being targeted. People need to be more aware of how it's affecting the families and why it's so important to for them to use this executive clemency. So can you explain to the audience exactly what that means and why it's so important in like details?
Yeah, sure. So so thank you for that overview. I think it's important to start and say that the executive branch of government, whether it's on a state level or a federal level, is entrusted with the ability to grant clemencies. And clemencies refer to two things. One is a pardon, which are generally given for people who already served a prison sentence or a jail sentence. Mm-hmm. It is to largely help to relieve the collateral consequences of that conviction. And commutations are generally given to people who are still serving a prison or jail sentence. And it is to either release them immediately or to push them closer to their earliest release date. And so those two things, pardons and commutations, together are what are commonly referred to as clemencies. And so the executive branch is entrusted with this ability to grant clemencies as a way of checks and balance. There are ways that the legislative branch of government checks and balances the executive and the judicial, and judicial does the same for executive and legislative. And so the executive branch is entrusted with this authority. The governor has the ability to grant pardons and commutations every day if he wanted to. There is no limitation to how much he can give every time that he gives. So if he wanted to issue clemencies 100 a day for 365 days, he could literally do that. But what that means is that every person that is either given a pardon or a commutation, that you know that the governor's name will always be linked to that individual. And it is a political political calculation that that the governor has to take to be able to screen and ultimately grant clemencies to individuals who fit a very stringent criteria. All too often, and in Governor Cuomo's examples, all of the individuals that he has granted a clemency to, whether it's a pardon or a commutation, have went through an extensive background check and have met certain criteria that all too often what he's getting is the cream of the crop or the most stellar individuals. And, you know, Dominic is a perfect example of that. And I won't overshadow his story and let him tell it. But that the reality is that we're looking at a very few individuals compared to how many people are currently incarcerated in New York State, which hovers around 50,000 people approximately. And more importantly, how many people have already served a prison sentence, come home, have already completed community supervision or parole, but still suffer from the collateral consequences of having a criminal conviction.
I'm really happy about it. I'm not bragging. I just want to say,
so
fucking ridiculous.
Absolutely.
If my father was alive today, I would go home and say, Dad, I'm going to tell you how much money I'm making. You know what he said? He was a lying motherfucker.
Yeah, I'm here. Hello? What's up? How you doing, mom?
What's good, bro?
What's up?
What's good?
What's good, bro? How are you? You all right?
I'm here, man. you know?
Yeah, so, man, I appreciate that. You know, I appreciate you and Khalil coming through.
My pleasure, my pleasure.
Definitely hearing about all the great things y'all doing out there from behind these walls, so, you know.
It's needed, bro, so.
Absolutely. So we were just touching on, Khalil was just telling us about clemency and pardon. And what are your views on Governor Cuomo using clemencies and pardons? Because we feel like he needs to exercise this a little bit more to give people that are working extra hard to prove that they are ready and they're willing to make a difference, like Dominic, and do something, make a change in society, especially with the youth. So how do you feel about clemency?
I agree. You know, I'm actually in here in one of these prisons where a lot of these programs were set in place after that unfortunate situation in Attica, where a lot of black men, a lot of men in general, lost their lives. So I definitely see all, you know, the opportunities here for someone to better themselves. So in an environment like this, when a man decides to change, you know, because in my opinion, you know, prison doesn't change somebody, like, for the better. The person has to want to change for the better. That's where the transformation begins. So all the tools are here, at least most of them. You know, these programs are here, especially Exodus. And, you know, so I believe that when somebody, you know, embarks on that journey of transformation and, you know, they're actually being accountable for the decision that they made to get them here, and, you know, they're involved in these programs, and, you know, they begin to change, the way they think begins to change. So I think that we're talking about rehabilitation. I think those people should have, you know, they should be able to utilize clemency and pardons to regain their freedom before that lengthy sentence has concluded. Because sometimes, you know, it doesn't take 25 years of life for somebody to become a better person. It's not a magic wand that's going to say on this day, on the 25th year, when this person gets before parole board, they're going to change and they're ready for society. Now, I believe that if we're talking about rehabilitation, you know, and this person shows that consistently, then I believe that they should qualify for that. And, you know, Dominic is a great example of that, as well as Khalil. So,
well, speaking on getting a second chance and rehabilitating back into society, on our last show, we briefly touched on the expungement of cases pertaining to marijuana charges. Why is it important for people to understand the significance and expungement of all cases after a specific amount of time? Because why should anybody, if you committed a crime 30 years ago and you're free from this crime, you paid your debt to society, why is it that when you enter back into society that everybody has to know what you did 30 years ago and then still judge you based off of that and expect you to react differently? That's contradicting.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with you. But before I turn it over to Khalil to talk about the expungement component and the decriminalization of marijuana and how that affects people that come from black and brown communities and marginalized communities, and this idea that this conversation that we're having is probably more about class than it is about race. And what I would also say is that this idea that a lot of us are fighting for a second chance, I would humbly say that a lot of people from my community are fighting for a first. Mm-hmm. You know, and, you know, this idea that these systemic systems that are in place that have us in a position where, in my humble opinion, dare I say, might be by design, where, you know, we lack education and we lack healthcare and we lack mm-hmm. employment and
resources.
You know, we lack resources, things that are in a bunch of other communities. You know, this idea that we fighting for a second chance. I mean, I really feel like I said, we fighting for a first.
I agree with
and,
that.
And you know, it's this big, you know, this big white elephant in the room that, you know, nobody want to talk about, but
yeah,
you know, you know, forget the pink one.
Yeah.
You know, let's call it what it is. And that's a serious issue, but you know, Khalil.
Yeah. So I mean, expungement of marijuana-related convictions was something that was historic in New York State that just happened in the last legislative session earlier this year. Mm-hmm. New York State, prior to that, has never had an expungement on the books. So the idea that a crime in New York State, especially for low-level amounts of drugs or what they call low-level drug offenses, you would have had to still have that record for the remainder of your life. In New York State, there is a sealing law, but sealing is different than expungement. Sealing is essentially saying that that case can't be accessed by certain people, but it could still be accessed by systems.
Mm-hmm.
And New York State passed a sealing law about 4 or 5 years ago, and now they just have an expungement. So expungement for low-level marijuana drug convictions is great, but it is not the end goal. The end goal should ultimately be that a person who has committed a crime, if they're actually indeed guilty, because surprise, surprise, there are people in the prison system who are completely innocent of the crime that they've been charged for.
When they see us.
Yeah. And right. So if a person has been convicted of a crime, they have been given a punishment, which is a term of imprisonment, whatever that term is. If a person during that sentence met all of the criteria that you need to meet to be released, and you are released, and then you are released to more than likely some form of community supervision, you then jump through all the hurdles that come with community supervision. Mm-hmm. On top of the fact you have navigated the biggest barrier to reentry, which is the negative stigma and perception that people have of someone with a criminal conviction, no matter what the criminal conviction is.
Right.
But especially if the criminal conviction required you to serve a lengthy period of time.
Right.
And so if you come home and you've navigated all of that, you've successfully completed supervision, and then you go on to be a productive member of society, why is it that in a country where we purport to be about second and third and fourth and fifth and sixth chances, the idea of redemption is one that's deeply rooted into many of the stories that we tell of the founders of this country. If we believe in that as a value of this country, then why is it that if someone has met all of that criteria, especially if that conviction is 15, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, why should that person not be able to say that their record has been expunged?
Right.
And I'll give an example of how when it benefits systems, they will allow you to actually have some level of expungement. When you talk about credit scores and credit reports and you talk about the idea of credit in this country, they have even instituted a period of time where your credit score and report is essentially allowed to hit a reset.
Right.
And they realize, because if you have credit, as most people do from the time you hit 17 or 18, your first 5 or 6 years of credit use will probably, unless you are well educated on how to use it, you will probably be using it in a very ill manner. Mm-hmm. And most people will actually end up being in debt unnecessarily. But as you hit the age of 25, it's surprise, surprise, when your frontal lobe is fully developed, you start making more conscious and more risk-averse choices, especially as it relates to finances. And so from the time you hit that number, if you have credit from the age of 18, you're actually allowed to reset your credit score if it is a bad one. And so the credit companies have instituted this process because they understand that the average person over the course of 7 years will probably change in the way that they have, in the way that they think and the way that their actions are displayed because of that changed thinking. Now, if we can do that with credit scores, if we can do that with other industries, why can't you do that with the criminal justice system?
Right.
And I'm asking that question in a very facetious manner because I know what the answer is. The answer is because it is in the benefit of systems to continuously allow them to judge someone despite no matter how long they have moved away from the conviction that they may or may not have actually been guilty of. However, interestingly enough, what we are talking about expunging criminal records has already been done in other states. And so we're not talking about instituting something in New York that is a pie-in-the-sky fantasy that somehow if it was instituted, it would be all-out warfare on the streets and innocent people would die on their way to work. In some of the most conservative states in this country, what they call quote-unquote red states, have actually passed legislation that allows for expungement. And, surprise, surprise, the sky hasn't fallen around them. And so we're not asking for something that has actually not been done. We are asking that New York State, what they call a triple blue state, which means that both houses in the legislative body are democratically controlled. Mm-hmm. The governor is a Democrat. New York State purports itself to be the most progressive state in the union, but undoubtedly the most progressive. New York City upholds itself to be the most progressive city in the world. And so you're talking about a state that has purported itself to be the most value-centered. And again, in those values, you talk about redemption, second chances, third chances, the ability to believe that a person has the intention and if given the access to resources, has the ability to change their life. We're asking New York State to just match what they say, match their rhetoric with action,
right,
which is to pass some form of expungement that includes other offenses outside of low-level drug offenses, and also includes, you know, drug offenses that are not marijuana, because quite honestly, you know, there are people that suffer from the same levels of addiction, if not worse, from drugs like heroin and opioids that don't get to benefit from the expungements that are about marijuana-related convictions. And it's only because we now view marijuana, the majority of Americans view marijuana very differently than they did 15, 20, 30 years ago. And that's all because of public education, because of research, and we now understand that, you know, even the medicinal uses of THC, is it THC?
Yeah.
And so we've done a huge shift as it relates to marijuana, but that shift needs to happen with other drugs, and it definitely needs to happen with people who have been convicted of violent offenses, violent felony offenses too.
I like that you go ahead, Ben.
I agree with Khalil and Dominic, and you know, I just want to add in my opinion that, you know, I don't think that a person should be defined by a choice they made in the past or a choice they made, period, because we change. And when we speak about rehabilitation, you know, when somebody shows that, when they consistent at that, or they actions today is indicative of that change, I think that to hold a black cloud over that person for the rest of their life because of a choice they made in the past, I think that's wrong. And you know, that's exactly what happens when we re-enter society with these criminal convictions, that, you know, it's always gonna be haunting us. It's always gonna be there. So
yeah.
I noticed that, you know, legislator always just, they always just wanna address the nonviolent crimes like marijuana, but you know, there's so many other things that people get incarcerated for, and that doesn't mean that just because somebody got arrested or convicted of a crime that they're like a career criminal.
Yeah.
You know, it was just a choice. So, you know.
Yeah.
Well, these convictions,
yeah,
they really affect people's lives, their families. You know?
I mean, absolutely. I would also add to that the choice to hold a criminal conviction over someone's head is not all across the board.
Absolutely.
So let's not even fool ourselves to believe that everyone with a criminal conviction comes home, that they're somehow limited because of that criminal conviction. And I'll give you two prominent examples of how they've moved so far away from their criminal conviction that most people don't even remember that they are associated with being in prison or going through jail. One of them is Martha Stewart.
Yeah.
Most people, when they think of quote-unquote felon, or they think of someone with a criminal conviction, they don't think of Martha Stewart. And Martha Stewart served time in a federal prison.
Mm-hmm.
The other person is Robert Downey Jr. I mean, people, you know, they love this man because of the movies that he has been in. But more importantly, there's a whole generation of kids that will always see him as Iron Man.
Mm-hmm.
And he has made millions of dollars. And rightfully so. He's a very talented individual. And what I'm saying is that we shouldn't hold them back because of their criminal conviction. What I think what we're all saying is that the same way that they were allowed to move past their criminal behavior or criminal choices in the past, because of whatever reason, Robert Downey Jr. had a very, very documented history of substance abuse from the age of 6 when he talked about smoking weed with his father at 6. And so, but there's a bunch of other Robert Downey Jr.'s that are not white.
Right.
And there are people who, you know, we've met in prison that from the time they're 18, they are five-star general and have command of a lot.
Absolutely.
And they have been traumatized from the very young age. But
and
when
re-traumatized.
Yeah, exactly. And
by
so
the systems that's in place that, you know,
but when they come home, they're not given the access to opportunity and the access to move past their criminal conviction like someone like a Robert Downey Jr. and someone like a Marcus Stewart. And best to and understand, like, there are a bunch of other people that are prominent people who have had histories of substance abuse and substance use and ill choices that have given them criminal backgrounds, but yet we don't let that dictate who they are. We let them, you know, we let them, in many cases, educate our children through their music, through their acting, through their writing. And again, I'm not saying hold those people back. What I'm saying is everyone should have that same access
opportunity
and the ability to move past their criminal conviction.
Absolutely, bro.
I want to add to that real quick. I think that, you know, one of the steps in that direction, like before somebody even, you know, have this criminal record is, you know, what is it? It's like an alternative pro reformative justice. That's what it's called. You familiar with that?
I think it's restorative justice.
Restorative justice. Yeah, restorative justice. But me and a couple of the guys in Bard College, we were just, you know, having a conversation about that. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, is needed. Like, we need more programs like that. Because that right there is like, it's not just saying throw somebody in prison and just forget about them. It's saying that give them the opportunity to sit down with their victim and, you know, try to correct that wrong. And, you know, you have the possibility of just living your life without having that choice hung over your head for the rest of your life, you know. So, and another thing too, Khalil, that we were just talking about, like, we know that there's a lot of systematical racism going on. Like, we know that a lot of these like things that's happening to us as a people in our communities, it's we're targeted. It's being directed to us.
By design, bro. Like, bottom line.
You know, so we know what's going on, but it's not about pointing a finger anymore. It's just about what we can do and taking accountability for the choices we made. At least that's how I go about it on a daily basis. And, you know, I see you guys making moves on a wider scale. Like, you're actually, you know, trying to affect change on a bigger scale, as opposed to just, as well as, I'm saying, holding individuals accountable for the things they're doing. You know, so, I definitely, like, recognize that, but.
Thanks, appreciate that. Shout out to Bard, shout out to Max Kenna, shout out to all the guys that are staying focused and elevating themselves and making sure that, like you said, we're not pointing a finger, we're aware about what's going on, and we are making steps to address these situations by using education as a platform and a catalyst to address the injustices that are happening in the system that they claim is just.
We here, man. You guys are carrying the torch, man. Like, we here. You know, so we're here watching, and I'm just eager to get out there so I could just do my part.
Absolutely.
And, you know, with that, I'm going to let you guys do your thing, your baby.
Yeah.
You know, talk to you tomorrow. I love you.
Love you, too.
And, God safe, all right? Yo, Khalil, you already know, bro. Respect, yo.
Yeah, thank you,
yo, bro. Yo, Dom, love, yo, bro.
Love,
y'all be
love.
Easy.
Yeah, stay up, bro. All right.
Later.
All right. So, what are some things you've learned about society and the system since being directly affected?
Wow. I can't curse too much because my daughter's here.
Yeah. I think I would start off by saying that, it's a lot of work to be done. You know, that's just the reality of the situation. It's a lot of work to be done. I think that, you know, we are in a place where we have to have conversations. I feel like everything begins with a conversation, and that we have to be in a place where we acknowledging what's going on and work with decision makers and people who, you know, are working in the policy area and in the legislature and the Senate to, and, you know, our city council and our local politics, you know, we have to, you know, we have to be aware that, you know, it's necessary to vote. But what I also say is what I learned about society is that, you know, there's a lot of people that's not really aware.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. we have to continue to educate people. We have to continue to make people aware of some of the things that's going on if we're going to make change. And that could be messy, you know.
Yeah.
That's just the bottom line. And the last thing I'll say before I turn over to Khalil is that we got to continue to support each other and be there for each other
mm-hmm.
and our families who are on the front line. You know, there's not enough there's not enough being said about the women and men and family members that continue to support us when we're in the belly of the beast. I mean, on the backs of our wives,
yeah.
who continue to support us and, you know, make trips to the court and to the supermarket and to, you know, to work and, you know, and just, you know, just the weight of life and, you know, taking care of children, and it just goes on and on. So, you know, so with that said, I wanna definitely give a shout out to my beautiful wife Stacy, who's in the building. And I
shout
wanna,
out to Stacy.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I wanna give a shout out to all the other family members and friends who continue to support, you know, the 2.2 million people that are incarcerated in the land of the free, right? Like, I know, you know, how do you put that number in the same sentence of,
right.
you know, the land of the free, right? It's a bigger conversation. I feel it needs to be said. But I think that we need to continue to make society aware of what's going on. And we need to continue to support those who supported us and acknowledge, you know, women like, you know, my wife Stacy and you and Shamika and, you know, all the other men and women and brothers and sisters and grandparents and everybody who's in this fight and in this struggle. And, you know, one of the things I've really learned is that these struggles and these fights have been on the backs of women from, you know, Harriet Tubman to, you know, Rosa Parks to, you know, as far as you can think back. And, you know, I think it's important to, you know, to give you, you know, your respect and give you your, you know, your props and your roses while you're alive, you know.
So, absolutely.
So thank you. Hello?
Yeah, I second and third that for sure. And then I'll say what I've learned about society as it stands right now. Because society, when I came home in 2010, was a very different time. You know, we are living in probably the most contentious years of this country's history in the past 30 or 40 years. Even, you know, even with events like 9/11 and other events, like, we are living in a time where we are the most mistrustful of each other.
Mm-hmm.
We are the most scared, the most terrified. And at the same time that we have an administration that through their actions have shown that they are only concerned about the upper echelon of this country's society, simultaneously we have people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. We have people like Rashida Tlaib. We have people like Tiffany Caban, who ran for Queens District Attorney, who, although she didn't win, really shook up the Queens political machine. Like, we are living in a time that that has produced both of those. And it is only through the most desperate of times that the most courageous acts are actually done. Because when you're the most desperate is when you actually are going to be the most courageous.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's inspiring and at the same time terrifying.
Yeah.
Because no doubt about it, whatever happens after this presidency, this is the presidency that will be studied and evaluated and broke down and stripped down to its core for the next 40 or 50 years. The same way that we look at the Nixon administration and now stuff is still coming out about recordings that were done in that administration, decisions that were made by the political team in that administration, is the same way that we're going to learn about this administration and the acts that they are doing now. We're going to learn about that 40 or 50 years from now. And so that's what I've learned about the society that we are currently in, because it is a different context. Mm-hmm. And what does that mean is that, you know, people ask all the time, you know, like, why do you do this work? And, you know, it's just like Ricky said, like, we are only holding the torch for a period of time. It is our responsibility to pass that torch on in its best condition to the generation after us. And the reality is that although that torch looks very dim right now, it will light back. It will get its brightness back. Yeah. But it will only get its brightness back if we decide not to give up, if we decide to fight one day longer than the opposition, show up to the battlefield one day more than the opposition, and we will win. Because it's one thing about people who are oppressed, they will keep fighting. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, chattel slavery happened in this country for 400 plus years. And, you know, civil rights was a 20, 30 year fight. And even MLK himself said, look, we're going to get to the mountaintop. Now, I don't know if I'm going to be there with you, but I believe wholeheartedly that we will get there. And it's the same way that I believe that one day we will end mass incarceration. We will undoubtedly change the system that we call mass incarceration. But it's only because people have to be courageous and get up and fight every single day. And sometimes the fights are in studios like this. Sometimes the fights are at a press conference. Sometimes the fights are at rallies in front of elected officials' office. But in the end, we have to continue to fight, because that's the only way that we're going to pass on a torch that's even holdable by the future generations.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So speaking of being involved with passing the torch and your career path and things like that, what has been the most challenging thing in your career in justice reform, and how was it breaking into the industry of reform? Because it's a very, very difficult and tough industry to get into. And you know, from my personal experiences and when I speak to a lot of other wives and mothers of those that are incarcerated, there's so many different organizations and people that are saying that they're here to help us. And when it comes down to them actually putting in the work, nobody's really there. You're by yourself. But you guys have been very effective at this. So how was that?
Well, so for me, you know, I have to acknowledge that a lot of the conversations that I'm having right now started prior to me even being released, like educating myself about, you know, policy and parole and understanding that it was important for me to figure out what was going on within me that even led me to a place where I would be in prison 20 years, 7 months, and 18 days with a life sentence, and understand that, you know, if I was going to be an example, that required me educating myself and finding out who were the people that were not just talking a talk but walking a walk. So I saturated myself in programs and connected myself with people who were doing the work from the inside out, which ultimately led to me getting out. And at the same time, interestingly, my uncle was involved in roles in his career that really had nothing to do with gangster roles, you know, Omar from The Wire and Chalky White from Boardwalk Empire. And then he moved into a direction where he started to use his platform to change the narrative and started getting roles that were centered around having a conversation about the criminal justice system and the school-to-prison pipeline and now When They See Us. So it was fairly easy for me to be inserted into that role, because I realized that for me, good programming was good security, and that if we were going to change things, that we needed to connect with people who were policymakers to have conversations about education within the prison system and having district attorneys fund those systems and second chances and first chances and using my lived experiences in prison to have a conversation about some of the changes that I felt needed to be made. Not from a perspective of me just talking about it, but me living about it. It was documented. It was, you know, it was clear that, you know, that I needed to impact my community in a very, very positive way. So, and what's also interesting about that is that Khalil and I sat in the same rooms doing this type of work. You know, he got there first and then, you know, was dealing with his immigration situation and then got back out, and then I came out right behind him. So, I love the work that we do because we lived it, and for us to be in a space where we could, you know, continue to reach back in. Side from the outside, mm-hmm. and like you know use our platform, you know, to come in and say this is the reason why we need to look at and change things is really humbling for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that it's important to highlight that our experience with reentry and our experience with advocacy and getting involved and sometimes being pulled into circles is largely couched in New York City's experience. I mean, New York City is a city where you can, you know, walk around and say, look, I was incarcerated, I did 20 years. And, you know, for the most part, people won't shun you, people won't judge you, people will kind of embrace you. And that's different when you go to Nassau County. That's different when you go to Westchester. That's different when you return to one of the more rural parts of this state. And if you look at some of the more conservative parts of this country, there are people that serve prison sentences and come home and don't even mention to family members that they did time.
Wow.
Because the stigma and the shame associated with that is still very deep.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's important for us to say that. I think it's also important for us, as Dominic kind of alluded to, is that, you know, we're two heterosexual males who serve time in a prison, in a state prison. There are people who are coming home that don't fit that criteria, particularly women. Their reentry experiences are very different.
Yeah.
There are a plethora of programs that are available for men, not that many, unfortunately, that are available for women. And so with that said, you know, the non-for-profit industrial complex is a whole nother show that we should be talking about. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the reality is that there are people in this business, it's a good thing you use that word because that's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
There's people in this business that are here to make money. And there are people who are going to be retiring with homes and second homes and summer homes and boats and all of that because they call themselves, quote unquote, advocates of the criminal justice system.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not against doing good and doing well. Like, I actually believe that we as people of color have been given this false choice that you can either do good or do well. And that, to me, is just BS. Like, we should have the ability to do good and do well.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying that we all shouldn't be able to do that. But what I'm saying is that there's people who, in the end of it, could not really give two ish about what happens to people of color in the criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. But as long as they are able to write, to host a successful podcast, as long as they're able to write a book, as long as they're able to get that, you know, to get that spot on one of the major networks, then, like, they're cool with that. But then there are people that have all of that, and they are the ones that are actually doing the work that many advocates are not willing or that they can't stomach to do, including things like meeting with this administration. As hard as that is, there are advocates out there who take that one on the chin for the movement, because somebody got to be at that table. Everybody can't be at that table, but the person who goes there has to have a rock iron stomach to be able to sit in front of someone that you actually really don't like,
mm-hmm.
and work with them for the better good of people that you may never actually meet.
Yeah.
That
takes a lot. All right, so we have reached the final segment of Facing the Truth. In closing, 95% of prisoners will eventually come home. What they do while in prison matters. Instead of treating them like animals and allowing criminal behavior and mindsets to set in, prisons should be focused on preparing people to re-enter into society and be good people when they get home. We spend too much money for them to just sit there when they could be learning, developing life, and working on skills, receiving treatment for substance and mental health issues. They should be changing their lives, earning earlier release, if they have demonstrated real rehabilitation. So with that being said, you guys keep that in mind and stay tuned for next week's show on Facing the Truth on DTF Radio at 9 o'clock. Thank you guys for tuning in.
Thank you, McKinney.
Thank you guys
Thanks,
for being
Kenny.
Here.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having us.
We gon' be all right. Do you hear me? Do you feel me? We gon' be all right. Nigga, we gon' be all right. Huh? We gon' be all right. Nigga, we gon' be all right. Do you hear me? Do you feel me? We gon' be all right. What you want? You a house? You a car? 40 acres and a mule? A piano? A guitar? Anything? See, my name is Lucy. I'm your dog. Motherfucker, you can live at the mall. I can see the evil, I can tell it. I know it's illegal, I don't think about it. I deposit every other zero, thinking of my partner. Put the candy, painting on a Rico, digging in my pocket. And a profit big enough to feed you every day. My logic, get another dollar just to keep you in the presence of your Chico. Ah! I don't talk about it, be about it. Every day I sequel. If I got it, then you know you got it. Heaven, I can reach you. Pet dog, pet dog, pet dog, my dog, that's all. Pick back and chat, I trap the back for y'all. I rap, I black on tracks, so rest assured. My rights, my wrongs, I write till I'm right with God. When you know, we been hurt, been down before. Nigga, when our pride was low, looking at the world like, where do we go? Nigga, and we hate po-po, wanna kill us dead in the street for sure. Nigga, I'm at the preacher's door, my knees getting weak and my gun might blow, but we gon' be alright. Right?
Nigga, we gon' be alright. Nigga, we gon' be alright. We gon' be alright. Do you hear me? Do you feel me? We gon' be alright. Nigga, we gon' be alright. Huh? We gon' be alright. Nigga, we gon' be alright.
In my prayers.
I remember you was conflicted, misusing your influence. Sometimes I did the same.